The new book puts Native Americans at the center of the history of the United States. But that hasn't always been the way that story's been told. Growing up, I could think of three ways Native American cultures were usually treated in school and pop culture. One, they were ignored. Settlers just sort of moved into an empty wilderness. Two, they were treated as an obstacle to U.S. expansion. Three, more sympathetically, they were treated as victims of American expansion. In his new book, our guest re-examines that history by incorporating the stories of indigenous communities as active participants in that history and focusing on the interrelationships between Native peoples and European settlers and their descendants. He says you can't really understand American history without those stories. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about U.S. history and its indigenous cultures? What do you want to know about Native people's history here in Wisconsin? In a bit, we're going to look at some more recent chapters in Wisconsin history. Do you have an experience to share? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ned Blackhawk is the author of the new book, The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples and the Unmaking of U.S. History. He's Western Shoshone and a professor of history at American Studies at Yale University. He was on the faculty at UW-Madison from 1999 to 2009. Ned, welcome back to Wisconsin.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to quote here from your introduction. Here it goes. American history developed out of the epic encounter between Indians and European empires and out of the struggles for sovereignty between Native peoples and the United States. American Indians were central to every century of U.S. historical development. That, I think, Ned, sums up a lot of what you're trying to accomplish in this big book. Can you talk a little more about that recentering of our history?
I'm happy to. The new book attempts to provide a single volume interpretive overview of Native American history and does so, as you indicated, by looking at every century of American historical development and formation. And each chapter and the two halves of the book are attempt to ground Native peoples, their power, their agency, their resiliency, and their struggles for survival at the heart of the American historical experience.
And I want to talk about some examples in earlier American history. One case you make is that we can't really fully understand the development of the U.S. Constitution without looking at the interaction between this fledgling nation and the Native American communities that it was encountering. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Chapter 6 concludes the first half of the volume, and it's about the formation of the U.S. Constitution, the place of Native Americans within it. And as you suggest, it makes an argument, as do the other chapters, that these kind of quintessentially paradigmatic moments of American, in this case, political and legal history, are indelibly imprinted by the presence of Native Americans and the larger context of Native American history. You likely have learned at some point that the first government in the United States wasn't very successful. It's the Articles of Confederation, which governed the Continental Congress during the Revolutionary Struggle. It was a disempowered kind of national political community or governing structure. I think I write somewhat playfully that the Articles of Confederation constricted more than they confederated. And it lacked the power that the eventual federalist system would develop through the constitutional government. The myriad ways that Native people shaped the formation of the Constitution are evident in the text itself. And so we could turn to the Commerce Clause. We could turn to the representational proportionment portions, and later to the 14th Amendment itself, all of which mention Native peoples or Indians. Indians are mentioned three times in the Constitution. And that inclusion reflects the centrality of Native peoples to the evolving concerns of the founders. And so one of the few areas of consensus that emerged out of the early deliberations within the Constitutional Convention in the summer of 1787 in Philadelphia was that there was a critical need for a stronger national government capable of handling interior diplomatic, military, and political relations with Indians. So the Commerce Clause has these kind of five, extremely important words. that lodge the authority, that all the states cede the authority to the federal government to conduct commerce between the states and with foreign nations and with the Indian tribes are the five words. And that's just one example. The Constitution also upholds the existing treaties, both made and to be made by the United States government, to be the supreme law of the land. And so treaties become, as you know, in Wisconsin, central elements of the kind of evolving doctrine of federal Indian law and policy that are struggled for and upheld and often reinterpreted throughout the territorial and state histories of many Midwestern states, Wisconsin included.
Talking to Ned Blackhawk about his new book, The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples and the Unmaking of U.S. History. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ned, I'm going to fast forward past a bunch of history to one of the chapters I got to admit I knew the least about, and it had a really important role to play here in Wisconsin. In 1950s, an effort to terminate the existence, the status of tribes in tribes around the United States. I want to start with a listen to Ada Deer of the Menominee here in Wisconsin talking about that Termination Act, speaking here in 1976.
Termination was a disaster, politically, economically, culturally. Our roles were closed, and this has a very drastic effect on Indian people. I remember one old Indian man in our traditional village of Zor telling me that one day he was an Indian and the next day he was not.
Ned, take us to the 1950s and this move in the federal government to toward termination, toward ending the status of many tribes around the country.
You know, I want to thank you for including that that segment there. I hadn't heard it before and look forward to learning more about it. You may not know that Ada was the director of the American Indian Studies Program at Madison when I was working there, and we worked, you know, together for many years. And she's recently released a beautiful autobiography that relays a lot of this history. It's published with the University of Nebraska Press, and it highlights this kind of dramatic turn in federal Indian policy that occurred in the aftermath of the Second World War and during the early years of the Cold War era. As she suggests in your segment, this was a disaster. This was like one of the worst kind of potential political decisions the federal government has ever made regarding Native American communities, at least in the 20th century. It was an attempt to essentially abrogate those treaty relationships I referenced earlier, to return essentially tribal communities over to states, where the Menominee, for example, her tribe became a county within the state of Wisconsin, and essentially to remove what was often called federal supervision. More legally, we would call it the federal trust doctrine, where the federal government holds reservation lands in trust and operates in partnership with tribal governments, the maintenance and welfare of the lands, resources, and communities upon them. So in the early 1950s, in 1953, the Congress passed a concurrent resolution known as House Concurrent Resolution 108 that legally terminated the political distinctiveness of Native nations. And each tribe, there were about 100 that got terminated, including the Menominee, who were able to delay the process a little bit into the early 60s. Each tribe essentially lost its standing as a reservation community. So what happens to tribal members? Well, the federal government's also going to subsidize their one-way migration or urbanization into urban centers through a program notoriously or infamously known as relocation. So these are the two national policies of the federal government in the early years of the Cold War, termination, relocation. These are assimilative efforts to disaggregate the jurisdictional autonomy and the sovereign authority of tribal communities, to assimilate their individuals into the body politic of the United States by sending particularly young families and individuals away from tribes to urban environments, and to erode a doctrine of federal Indian law and policy that dates back, you know, essentially to the founding, that had created bilateral treaty relationships between hundreds of tribes and the federal government, and also importantly, financial and other kind of federal commitments and healthcare, housing, education, and other kind of components. And so the Menominee, as you may know, have a longstanding sustainable timber industry that's one of the most respected in North America. And it was heavily undercut and threatened by this challenging and difficult policy that came into being and lasted until the early 70s, when Ada, you know, very, very heroically and others led an effort to get their tribal sovereignty restored in the Restoration Act of 1973. So Ada's in the book. There's a nice image of her overseeing the Secretary of Interior as he's signing these Restoration Acts. There's a lot of that history that's conveyed, and I wouldn't obviously have really been able to understand it the way I try to without those years of experience back in Wisconsin.
Talking to Ned Blackhawk, author of the book, The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples and the Unmaking of U.S. History. He's a professor of history and American studies at Yale University. Before that, he was on the faculty at UW-Madison, looking at the history of the United States and Wisconsin from the perspective of Native peoples, indigenous communities, and how they interacted with the U.S. government. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think that we focus enough on Native American history and its role in the wider story of the United States? If you're Native American yourself, are you seeing more of these stories getting told, more of this history being taken seriously in your own community and beyond? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Ned Blackhawk from Yale University. He's authored the new book, The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples and the Unmaking of U.S. History. His book explores the importance of Native peoples and indigenous cultures to the United States and Wisconsin up to the present day. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Jonah is with us in Menominee. Jonah, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to bring up, Jonah?
So I had a question about the Caribbean, the indigenous peoples in the Caribbean. So when European folks came over and colonized those areas as well as the mainland, throughout their history, have any of the Caribbean nations that still have been controlled by the U.S. over all this time, like the U.S. Virgin Isles, for example, have any of them identified as Native Americans? Where geographically are the cultural lines drawn?
Jonah, thanks for the call. Ned, you focus, I think, on mostly mainland United States here. Do you have thoughts for Jonah on Native cultures beyond the U.S. borders or, as Jonah says, in U.S. territories in the Caribbean?
That's correct. It is mainly a history of a continental history of North America, or at least the contiguous United States. Chapter one does explore the kind of initial phases of Spanish settlement and colonization in the Caribbean. Sketches some of the incredibly destructive impacts that early phases of Spanish colonial rule, exploitation, enslavement, and disease introduction had on the indigenous populations. These are some of the darkest chapters in the history of the Western Hemisphere and include the wholesale slaughter and often extermination of dozens of indigenous communities. Native Americans in those regions did survive. Many became incorporated into labor regimes, into various religiously organized mission communities and other forms of Spanish settlement society. And that survival has imprinted itself on numerous distinct, or there's been a distinct imprint of that survival within a series of Caribbean nations. In Puerto Rico, for example, the Taino communities retreated into many of the highland regions of the island and forestalled Spanish conquest for generations and indeed even centuries. It's also true in places of Hispaniola and other kind of more mountainous Spanish colonial regions. So it'd be helpful to understand the kind of distinct imperial regimes or nation states that eventually, or empires that eventually controlled these islands, because many were heavily exploited and turned into plantation societies, particularly among the English and French kind of colonial holdings across the Caribbean. But it's a really interesting kind of comparative lens to think about this history more broadly.
Thanks for that call, Jonah, at 800-642-1234. Ned, I want to look at another portion of the book now. And again, history I wasn't familiar with. Some of the first violence in the U.S. at the outbreak of the Civil War was actually militias in the West targeting Native American communities there. Can you share some of that history with us?
I can. And I appreciate that kind of opportunity to do so because, again, like with the Constitution, there's a big chapter, or at least an ambitious one in my own mind, on the origins of the Revolution in the volume. And there's a chapter on the Civil War that opens in the West and tries to lodge indigenous history at, if not the center of the conflict itself, as one of its kind of central legacies. Mm-hmm. Because the conflict between the Union and the Confederacy is, you know, inarguably the crucible of American history. And most American history classes are, you know, divided in half or begin before or after the Civil War era. At least the survey classes of American U.S. history offered often in universities and colleges, like at UW-Madison, where we have, I think it was History 101 and History 102. Mm-hmm. And even AP history classes in the country often are up to and before the Civil War. So there is a, you know, just an incredibly vast, not just literature of scholarship on the subject, but an incredibly kind of set of developed understandings and paradigms for understanding this era. And they've kind of overwhelmingly failed to not just understand the tens of thousands of indigenous lives that were also lost during these crucial years, but also the legacies of the war itself. Because that's one of the major themes of that chapter and of the next chapter. Because the federal government during the war develops a capacity to do things that it had never been able to do. And so there's a series of examples, case studies, and even kind of anecdotes that kind of highlight this. One of my favorites is that when Lincoln was campaigning in 1860 and gave this famous speech in Cooper Union, New York, it took him 4 days and I think 5 different trains to make it to New York City from Springfield. And each train he traveled had a different size gauge so that there was no kind of regionally united or national railway system. By the end of the war, and this is the opening scene of a few famous books on the subject, Lincoln, after his assassination, is carried slowly by train throughout most major northern and midwestern urban centers, and his coffin is draped and shrouded in black and also travels at 5 miles an hour across a newly constituted railway system. So that image really just stayed with me as a kind of representational kind of frame for thinking about the dramatic transformations that the war unleashes, one of which is obviously militarily. There are roughly 20,000 Union soldiers in 1860. Nearly a million will serve on behalf of the Union itself, including, I think, approximately 180,000 African-American soldiers. Just to get this is a nearly exponentially larger military force. So the federal government is increasingly generating what we would think of now as the modern American administrative state during these years. And it's establishing federal funding and subsidies for not just national militaries, but state organized militias as well. And so there's been a series, or there were a series of campaigns already in existence throughout California during the long period of the California Gold Rush, in which white settler communities and their militias increasingly targeted and destroyed, particularly mountainous and Northern California Indian communities. And once the war begins, then they start appealing for state and then later federal funding to do so. So I make a suggestion that these are, in fact, the first casualties of the Civil War, Indians killed by state militias using federally funded resources to enforce a new kind of property and political and kind of racial regime that will ultimately lead to, as is widely recognized in the field, the genocide of tens of thousands of California Indians.
Ned, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Ned Blackhawk. Ned was a UW-Madison faculty member for 10 years. Now he's a professor of history and American studies at Yale University. We've been talking about his new book. It's called The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples and the Unmaking of U.S. History. He joined us today to share a history that centers around the experiences of indigenous peoples and how they helped to shape the Wisconsin and the country that we know today.